Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York officials are demanding answers on that federal Newburgh warehouse as details remain shrouded in secrecy. Kimberly Izar has the latest. New York is investing $18 million to improve safety on Route 17 between Parksville and Liberty. We'll hear what drivers can expect as construction gets underway and why these upgrades are needed on one of the region's busiest travel corridors. As America prepares to celebrate its 250th birthday, we're traveling back to the Revolutionary War, not to the battlefield, but to the campfires, the marching routes, and the daily lives of the soldiers. Plus, we'll speak with award-winning filmmaker Gwendolyn Cates about The Doctrine, a powerful new documentary. It's coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is threatening another round of attacks against Iran.
We hit him very hard last night. Very, very hard. Probably hit him hard again tonight. I'll give him a little warning. We're going to hit him hard tonight.
Speaking at the NATO summit in Turkey, Trump declared the U.S. ceasefire with Iran over after the two sides exchanged airstrikes across the Middle East overnight.
I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people. And they're vicious, violent people. And if they had a nuclear weapon, they'd use it.
The price of oil rose about 6% after Trump's comments on Iran, climbing to $78 per barrel. That's the highest level in more than 2 weeks. Stocks on Wall Street opened sharply lower this morning after renewed fighting between the U.S. and Iran. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 530 points in early trading.
Crude oil prices jumped after President Trump declared an end to the shaky ceasefire with Iran. The U.S. launched strikes against dozens of targets along the Iranian coast in retaliation for attacks on several ships trying to cross the Strait of Hormuz. The renewed fighting could put more upper pressure on domestic energy prices. AAA says retail gas prices rose less than a penny a gallon overnight. A springtime spike in jet fuel prices has been costly for U.S. airlines. Newly released government figures show U.S. carriers spent more than $6 billion on jet fuel during the month of May. That's an 84% increase from the same month a year ago. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, down in Tokyo, Seoul, and Shanghai, but up in Hong Kong. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Health officials in Gaza say airstrikes carried out by Israel have killed at least 8 Palestinians. NPR's Anas Baba reports the victims included 2 children and an official from an Egyptian aid group.
Health officials say Israeli airstrikes across Gaza killed 8 Palestinians on Tuesday at a time when thousands were watching Egypt play against Argentina in the World Cup. Those killed included 2 brothers ages 10 and 8, and an official with the Egyptian Relief Committee operating in Gaza. The aid organization says Mohammed al-Wahidi is its 4th official killed during the ceasefire. The Israeli military says it struck a Hamas operative traveling in a vehicle in northern Gaza and that it's reviewing reports that civilians were harmed. According to health officials, 1,080 Palestinians have been killed during the ceasefire in Gaza. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza.
A massive wildfire in southern Colorado continues to burn after destroying hundreds of homes and other buildings. Firefighters across the West are working to contain other large fires in Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, and Washington. This is NPR News. The governor of Illinois has signed new legislation aimed at increasing oversight of advanced artificial intelligence systems. The measure requires developers to disclose how they evaluate catastrophic risks and report serious incidents within set deadlines. Families with school children have started to receive their school supply list for the fall. Surveys show many are expecting to spend more. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Most of back-to-school shopping happens much closer to the start of the school year, but a survey by the National Retail Federation finds that more back-to-school shoppers have gotten a head start early than in years past. Almost a third say they've started looking. Inflation is a big concern, so people are deal hunting, but also more families seem to be getting their school lists earlier this year. In another survey by the consulting firm PwC, a much greater share of shoppers this year say they expect to spend more on back-to-school purchases from a year ago. PwC estimates that an average family might spend $922 on clothes, shoes, backpacks, laptops, and other technology and supplies. Alina Sialuch, NPR News.
The Trump administration is canceling plans to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. The idea was first announced during the Obama administration to replace President Andrew Jackson with the abolitionist on the front of the bill. The first Trump administration delayed the plan, and the Biden administration later tried to revive it. The currency was originally set to debut in 2020, in line with the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And we're going to hear about that ICE, suspected ICE facility in Newburgh, and also some more information that Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar has been telling us about and reporting on. But she's joining us now in the studio to help me as we continue our summer fun drive.
Day three.
We're talking about Wednesday, like the Wednesday hump day, trying to get over that feeling in the middle of the week. But what we're getting over now is 27% of our goal, which is great.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so day three, we're in a good spot, but we need to reach that $65,000 by the end of next week. We can do it sooner if we hear from you, 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org, or on the new mobile app. Yesterday, Kim was here, and we were telling you about all the great local journalism that she's been doing and all the team has been doing, and we're going to bring you some of the reporting in a minute. But Kim, when you're out and about and talking to folks in the community, you're also, you know, sometimes the only reporter there, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I was at this huge rally in Newburgh yesterday, and I think I was honestly only one of maybe two other reporters there. Oftentimes I'm at a legislative meeting or a really small village or town board meeting, and I'm the only reporter there. And I think, you know, Tim, we talk a lot about the value of local news, public radio, just being a public service and public good for the community. But when I'm in the community, I see it firsthand, and people come up to me all the time to tell me how appreciative they are for the station.
And you are out there doing it. We're so appreciative of you going out and doing that. You're not just sitting at your desk. You're out going to these events, far-flung events. This one we're going to talk about was in Newburgh, around the corner. And she lives here in our area, and she said to me yesterday, she said, I'm going to go home for dinner, and then I'm going to go to Newburgh. I'm like, that's not close. But you are committed to what you do. And we appreciate that so much, and appreciate so much that you're bringing these stories that we may not hear from other sources. You know, we are often overlooked in the national press and on some of the regional press. So to have this local presence is really, really important.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think about all the time just how special it is, the local, national, and international news that we bring to the station. I mean, it's really only here, you know, during this hour on Radio Chatskill, where you're going to hear about the Newburgh rally in just a few minutes and how national immigration policy is impacting our local neighbors here in the Hudson Valley. And then we're going to hear about the Route 17 improvements from our Sullivan County legislator, Louis Alvarez. We're going to hear about local businesses, what's happening in our community, from farmers, et cetera. And that's what makes this station so special.
You can support that by donating during our summer fund drive, 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org online, or via the app available for iPhone and Android. And you'll keep this local news going. You'll keep Kim going. You'll keep all of the team going with your support. We're listener-supported public radio. So join the community of supporters. If you haven't donated yet and you've been a listener for a while, this is the time to do it. And we know that folks tend to maybe listen and think, oh, somebody else might do it or somebody else is going to do it. But we really need you to do it.
You can be that person.
You can do that.
I mean, I get so excited to ring this bell, and I haven't been able to ring this bell in some time. So give us a call, 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org or on our mobile app. There's so many ways.
And we want to tell you about the story that Kim has been covering. She was at a rally in Newburgh in Orange County about the suspicion surrounding this
building, this office space in Newburgh, right, near Stewart International Airport. I think across the road.
It's basically just a mile down the road. I mean, if you're driving on 17K, on the left-hand side is Stewart International Airport. And then just a mile up is the industrial park, which is where this warehouse that the federal government is leasing to this Texas-based contractor. Again, we're going to hear in just a bit, but we really don't know much information, which is why I'm kind of like, this is what we know so far. But essentially, the news of this federal lease came just a couple months after, you know, Orange County residents opposed this proposed ICE facility in Chester that we reported on extensively earlier this year. You know, we've learned since that ICE told New York Assembly member Brian Maher that they're not pursuing these plans. But we do know about this new federal warehouse just from last week.
Yeah. And so New York officials and residents demanding answers. There was a rally last night.
Yeah. And I was there last night at the park in Newburgh, and it was hundreds of people. More than 300 people showed up to Newburgh last night, according to organizers, to oppose ICE's presence in the Hudson Valley. And here's some of the, you know, individuals I spoke to and some of the local officials.
No justice, no peace, no ICE on our streets.
No justice, no peace, no ICE on our streets.
No justice.
It's a gloomy Tuesday evening at Algonquin Park in Newburgh. But even with the rainy mist, a crowd gathers to demand answers.
We are gathered here today because something sacred is at stake. Something moral. Something deeply rooted in our faith, our history, and our shared humanity.
That's Sister Ileana Hernandez with the presentation of the Blessed Virgin Mary Congregation in New Windsor. She's one of the several hundred protesters at Tuesday's rally.
We're living in a moment where fear is being weaponized, where immigrants are being demonized, where family seeking safety are being treated like criminals. And we are told over and over, this is normal. Well, I am here to tell you, this is not normal.
Last week, the news broke that the federal government had quietly awarded a $35.5 million lease for a warehouse in the town of Newburgh to a Texas-based contractor called Leverage Enterprises, Inc. It was first reported by Project Saltbox, a public records watchdog monitoring immigration enforcement activity. While there's very little information known about what the warehouse will be used for, federal records suggest it could be for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. U.S. Representative Pat Ryan, who represents the 18th Congressional District, says he hasn't received any information about what the warehouse will be used for.
Once again, DHS and the Trump administration are giving no information, no transparency to me, to local elected officials, to community members, when we're asking the most basic questions. So the second we heard about this facility in Newburgh, we immediately made a strong formal request with a bunch of questions that we asked. They have not been responsive. It's the same playbook that they did in Chester. We will keep pushing, but frankly, they've been just a completely unaccountable, black box kind of an administration. The good news is we really did show that we were able to stop the facility in Chester. So this is a really encouraging moment here tonight. But we need more information, and we need people to understand that I think, as I said, this is probably the opening round of what could be a long fight to stop this. Yeah.
And what kind of response are you hearing from community members, residents, since this news came out?
People are furious. They are feeling like we worked so hard to stop the facility in Chester, and now like it's a double whammy to do this again in the same county, in essentially the same community, and especially in Newburgh, where we have such a vibrant immigrant community. It's really like right in the heart of all that's good about this community. They're trying to sow fear and chaos. So I am very optimistic, though, from this outpouring of support tonight and the calls we've gotten, the letters we've gotten already. And I appreciate you all getting the word out, too, because as people hear about this, just like the Chester facility, I know there will be a near unanimous rejection of this facility, too.
The protest was organized by a coalition including Indivisible, Fuerza Newburgh, the Democratic and Working Families Party, and others. The single-story warehouse is about roughly 42,000 square feet. It's about a mile from Stewart International Airport off Route 17K, which doubles as a public and military airport. In January, residents and lawmakers turned out to local and county board meetings and protests to push back against the proposed ICE detention facility in Chester. If built, it could have held up to 1,500 people.
Say it loud, say it clear!
Immigrants are welcome here!
Say it loud, say it clear!
Immigrants are welcome here!
That sound from a protest in January, where hundreds of people gathered outside a Village of Chester board meeting to oppose the plan. ICE has since abandoned its plans in Chester, according to State Assemblymember Brian Marr. Orange County legislator Genesis Ramos, who represents the town of Newburgh, says poor economic development has left the county susceptible to bad actors.
It's been decades of failed leadership that has prioritized warehouses as an economic development strategy and just a development strategy in general. And now we have vacant warehouses throughout the county that have just created fertile ground for us to be targeted by the federal government for these inhumane detention centers. So I think that yesterday it was Chester, today it's Newburgh, tomorrow it could be any other municipality with vacant warehouse. I think that DHS will continue to push the bounds and push the limits. And it's, again, it's very unfortunate that we have to fight this and that we are here in the first place. But that is exactly what failed leadership, with no foresight into future thinking and future planning about what it means to just be so focused on warehouses. This is what, unfortunately, some of the consequences that we're seeing.
Radio Catskill reached out to ICE, but did not hear back before the story aired. We also reached out to the General Services Administration, the federal agency responsible for managing federal leases and real estate for federal agencies. They did not answer whether or not the facility was for ICE, but said that they remain, quote, focused on supporting this administration's goal of fortifying the federal footprint and providing the best workplaces for our federal agencies to meet their mission, end quote. Ramos says she's not backing down, and that it's time to define more clearly Trump's immigration strategy.
Let's call it exactly for what it is. DHS and ICE have become an unserious rogue agency under this administration, with no regard for any level of government, no regard for oversight, no regard for the people whose lives they're wrecking. We shut it down in Chester. We stood up. We applied pressure. We did not back down. And we will shut it down here in Newburgh, too.
During the rally, attendees learned that a man in Houston, Texas, was shot and killed by an ICE agent during a targeted operation on Tuesday.
I said that as we stand here in opposition of ICE, just moments ago, an ICE agent fatally shot someone in Houston. But I would like to encourage us to do a moment of silence. Thank you. Thank you. Unfortunately, it's even more of a reason as to why we have to fight like hell to stop this.
Manny Tirado, treasurer of the NAACP Middletown branch, also fought back against the proposed ICE facility in Chester. He says he's surprised that he's fighting a similar fight now for the town of Newburgh.
I'm surprised and dismayed. I didn't think I have to. I mean, I would have thought that after we were successful, you know, and pushing back, the proposal in Chester that, you know, that the administration wouldn't try to do it elsewhere in Orange County. So I'm disappointed and I'm angry, you know, and I'm more worried.
Worried, he says, about what being so close to an ICE facility would mean for the large Black and Latino population in Newburgh, one of the most racially diverse parts of Orange County.
Okay, so, you know, so the physical presence of an ICE facility, you know, you worry about proximity, right? If they're here physically present, then there's concerns that there might be increased, you know, ICE enforcement here, right? You know, people might be running. Someone like myself was a person of color. And mind you, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm a U.S. Army veteran. Okay, and I have to be fearful now. I now have, I now carry identification showing my veteran status so that, God forbid, if I get stopped because of the color of my skin, I'll be able to convince an ICE agent, you know, that I'm a U.S. citizen and please don't detain me. You know, I mean, you know, I'm more conscious now.
Organizers say they plan to continue voicing their opposition at the town of Newburgh's next board meeting on Monday, July 13th. In Newburgh, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Kim Izar is here with us now. And a powerful rally last night in Newburgh.
It was, I was talking to some of the organizers after the protests, and they said that it was, if not the largest protest that they've seen in the town of Newburgh, one of. And some, you know, they did a headcount of probably more than 300 to 350, but some estimates probably are over 400. Mm. Yeah.
And then you were at that rally, got on 84 and then back on 17 to
oh,
get
yes.
back this way.
And there are some things that are going to be happening on Route 17, some exciting stuff, actually.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break, yeah. And you'll be back to tell us about this $18 million safety overhaul that's underway on Route 17 in Sullivan County. Kim will be back to tell us what these improvements mean for local drivers and how crews plan to minimize disruptions during the busy travel season. It's Radio Chatsco.
My name is Matt Word and loyal JFF listener. I just love having it on in the cart for the local goings-on.
I love the humor of it.
I listen to a lot of the news.
It's a very good news source.
It gives me the best information about what's happening in the community and about what's happening in the world.
I love the local. I love the farm and country. You name it. I just love it all. Everything.
Please give now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
You can also call 845-482-4141. Or on the mobile app. I'm Tim Bruno. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Kimberly Izar is with me here in the studio. Our summer fun drive is continuing. We want to thank, we heard from Ralph in Garrison, New York. And you get to ring the bell.
Yay! I love ringing the bell.
Thank you, Ralph, for your donation. And thank you for supporting local journalism, local culture, and all of the great community connections you hear on Radio Catskill. It's only because of folks like Ralph and so many others who have donated. And if you haven't donated yet, please join that community of supporters by calling 845-482-4141, going online, wjffradio.org, or donating via the mobile app. As we mentioned, Kim is driving all over the area to bring you news and information about what's going on. And one of the key things that's going on is the major busy corridor through our whole listing area, Route 17. There are some major construction happening there.
Yeah, and, you know, Tim, you and I both know, and the whole team, I mean, Route 17 connects us to so many parts of New York State. And, you know, just last week, New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced that New York is kicking off an $18 million project, which is going to improve safety along Route 17 right here in Sullivan County. And so that will include major safety upgrades between the Hamlet of Parksville and the Village of Liberty. During the summertime, Route 17 is especially busy. I think that it carries an average of 19,400 vehicles daily, according to the state, during the summer months. Super, super busy time. And so I spoke with Sullivan County Legislator Louis Alvarez about what kinds of safety upgrades residents can expect. What can you tell us about what that work will include exactly?
The main purpose of here is to actually repair a lot of holes in the conditions of this road and the way it's not level whatsoever. One of the biggest things I notice here on this particular road is that if you're in the passing lane or the driving lane, the metal in between the lane has a lot of holes that will cause damage to anybody that hits it with tire. But this will help the vibrations. Like one time I drove a fire truck from Liberty to Parksville, and the truck was really jumping a lot due to the conditions of the road. So this is an amazing project. We know about it. I know that the fire company says that one day is going to be one lane closed and another lane open. It will be an amazing job. We really need it.
And this project focuses on about 7 miles, centerline miles of pavement. Work includes resurfacing, repairs to concrete joints, upgraded guardrails, new signs, pavement markings, and the installation of audible rumble strips. What are you hearing from residents in your district about why these improvements are so important, especially right now?
You've got to remember that when you travel, people are north of Sullivan County. Anybody traveling in that direction is traveling on this route, and there will come to any damages, anything that's been created through the times. And yes, you're right. Those improvements are really needed for that particular road, that 7 miles that they're going to repair.
And is this project in Sullivan County different from the proposed Route 17 widening? I know that there's been this Department of Transportation proposed Route 17 widening to add a potential third lane to the highway. This is different than this, correct?
This is completely different. And I know that because I was involved in the first time when Governor Cuomo talked about it and wanted to expand it. So I'm very much familiar with it. No, this is something completely needed. This has nothing to do with widening the road. This has to do more with the safety of the public traveling on that road. It's needed. It's not like something that, yeah, we want to do it so it looks. No. That road needs to be repaired. Needs to be corrected. Right now, just drive it. Get on it, and you feel like you're bumping. You can feel the bumping. You can feel your tires going up and down as you're traveling there. It's not a clean, smooth surface. If I would go back there and ride on that road, you can hear my vehicle vibrating from it.
Oh, yes, Louis. I'm on Route 17 often, kind of in that area, and it's not a pleasant experience, depending on where you're driving. What can you tell us about the anticipated timeline for this project?
Well, I'm going to look at it from this way. Yesterday, there was a very, very storm. When I was coming from my daughter's house, traveling from Livingston Manor, this Route 17, once I got to this particular area past Parksville, with the rain, the weather condition, the visibility, and the way the condition of the road is, your vehicle was jumping and vibrating a lot and pushing from one side to the other. So you actually have to slow down your speed to be able to, be in that particular zone. But some people traveling next to you don't realize the conditions of the road, and they just keep going at a speed that's not good at the right. This has to be repaired. What do we do? We have to anticipate. We know. I know that the fire company, our chief, sent us a message about it, telling us the days they're going to be doing it. Two lanes will be closed. One lane will be open. Two lanes will be open. There is a program that they use it, and you can see them. If you go past Binghamton and you see all the roads they're fixing, you'll see that. They really make it in such a way that then you have to slow for a little bit. You have to sacrifice yourself a little bit here for the benefit of having a road that's really clear, paved, safe, and not so doesn't hurt your vehicle. I say it could damage tires, damage the brake system of your vehicle. So that's the way. We know it's going to happen. We are very much aware of it.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a $18 million investment into the county, with Governor Hochul saying that it could potentially anticipate a completion by winter of next year, 2027, that might have some potential ramp closures and minor delays. Obviously, this is, you know, a project through the state, but Sullivan County is in close communication with state officials. How will residents be notified of any potential closures or delays?
The state is going to do that particular part. And the state has sent us a letter, and I have one of those letters that specifically tells you what the routes are going to be, the times, and the periods. And at this particular part, I'll probably go and talk to Dan. From our viewpoint, we're going to try to inform the public everything that's happening, so everybody's in the clear of what's happening. It needs to be done. It's not something that, we're going to do it and closely. No. We'll try to inform everybody. And imagine the state is going to do it. They do a great job, and they do it very fast.
Legislator Alvarez, anything else you want to add?
You know, like I said, it's something during the construction, during that period of time, yes, one lane is going to be closed, one lane is going to be open. Just be cautious. I know it's going to delay you a couple of minutes. It may delay you a couple of seconds. It's not going to be a big delay. But your precaution, your observation, your safety comes first, then trying to run through there as fast as you can. Try to get to the, just take it slow. Take it easy. And go through and get wherever you are safe and with help.
We've been chatting with Sullivan County Legislator Louis Alvarez. Louis, thank you so much for chatting today.
No problem at all. Anytime.
And thanks to Kimberly Izar for that report and all of the reporting that she brings us, all the local news information that Kimberly and the entire team is bringing us. Your donation helps support that. You're helping to support paying for Kimberly's gas as she's driving all the way from Orange County to Sullivan County as well. Donate now, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org or on the WJFF Radio Catskill mobile app. After a break, we're going to talk with filmmaker Gwendolyn Cates about The Doctrine. It's a new documentary following indigenous youth as they take their concerns directly to the Vatican and explore how centuries-old policies continue to influence the present day. This is Radio Catskill.
Thank you for making Radio Catskill part of your summer. Wherever you go, whatever you do, if you're glad to have Radio Catskill with you, please help keep us here for everyone. Become a sound supporter by making a donation of $20, $30, $40 a month or more, or give a one-time gift of any amount. For this station to continue, we need your continuing support. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Donate on the mobile app or also call us at 845-482-4141. It's our summer fund drive. We are 27% of the way toward our $65,000 goal that we need to meet by the end of next week, the 17th. But help us get there quicker if you can. Call us at 845-482-4141 or go to WJFFradio.org. Coming up next, it's a story from our culture reporter, Valerie Manzi, who's joining us in studio. It's a really interesting look at a 15th century papal decree that justified the European conquest to continue to influence law, public policy, and indigenous communities today. Valerie, this is a really interesting doc. Tell us a little bit more about who you're speaking with.
Well, Gwendolyn Cates is an award-winning photographer as well as an award-winning filmmaker. And she has an interesting connection to the indigenous community. Her father was a linguist, and he studied with the Navajo out in maybe Arizona. I'm not exactly sure. And he learned the language Diné. Hmm. And he took her to out there. He took her to various indigenous communities throughout her childhood. And she became very interested and knowledgeable about these issues.
And I was going to say, and this film follows a group of indigenous teenagers on this journey to the Vatican where they seek to confront church leaders about this doctrine that I mentioned from the 15th century and the lasting impact it has. There's a screening of this documentary tonight at the Calicoon Theater at 7:30. And let's take a listen to your conversation with the film's director, producer, and award-winning documentary filmmaker, Gwendolyn Cates.
Award-winning photographer, documentary filmmaker, and author Gwendolyn Cates is here to tell us about her film, The Doctrine. The Doctrine is scheduled to be screened in Calicoon at the Calicoon Theater on Wednesday, July 8th. And she's here to tell us about her life in film and photography, but most of all, to tell us about her latest project, The Doctrine. Welcome, Gwendolyn.
Thank you so much, Valerie. It's a pleasure to be with you.
This documentary, as many of your other documentaries, deal with indigenous issues, correct?
That is correct.
And what drew you to that?
Well, it goes back to right before I was born. My father, who was a linguist, lived on the Navajo Nation in northern Arizona for 2 years to learn the language fluently. He was invited there by traditional people, and he did learn the language fluently. And then he began to bring me out there to visit when I was 11. So that was really the beginning and my introduction to indigenous people here and indigenous issues as well.
And also around that time, you picked up your first camera.
At age 9.
Oh, before that. Okay.
Yeah. My father actually gave me an Instamatic for, I don't remember if it was Christmas or birthday, and I was hooked. So I've had a camera in my hand since I was 9, and I still have that original Instamatic.
Well, good for you. Now, you've won a couple of awards as a photographer. Your photographs have been in major newspapers and magazines and exhibits.
Yeah, I was mainly a editorial photographer rather than a newspaper photographer. So my work was really more portraiture for magazine covers and features. I photographed a lot of very well-known people, from movie stars to like George Clooney to Rosa Parks.
Wow. And now you're doing documentary film.
Exactly. And that started because I was doing the editorial photography, and then I had an opportunity to publish a book. Actually, Grove Press published a book called Indian Country, which was the pub date was October 2001. And it's mainly portraits of people all over the United States. So the title is Indian Country, published by Grove Press. And then opportunity to make a film, or an invitation to make my first film, came from that book, as a result of that book. So I did my first film. And then I've done this film, The Doctrine, is my fourth feature-length documentary film.
And one of your films was about a New York City ballet dancer, Jock Soto.
That's right. That's the first film. So the title of the first film is Water Flowing Together, and it's about Jock Soto, who is Navajo and Puerto Rican. And so it was about his sort of, you know, looking at his identity as he was preparing to retire. And it also follows an artist through the difficult decision to, you know, for a dancer to give up the, you know, what they've always done. And that was picked up by PBS Independent Lens and was aired broadcast nationally for 4 years and won a whole bunch of awards. here and outside of this country, including Canada.
And what specifically led you to the doctrine?
So many years of education about Indigenous history and issues, often by Indigenous leaders who I have had the privilege to know and be mentored by. A previous film is The Good Mind, about the Onondaga Nation and Haudenosaunee Confederacy, that is mainly in New York State, but also goes over the border up into Canada. So that film is about, focuses on the central fire or capital of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And so then I made a film about Standing Rock, and we're now coming up on that. It's really the 10th anniversary of Standing Rock. So I had learned about the doctrine of discovery, 11, 12 years ago, initially.
And what is the doctrine of discovery? I learned about it because I went to Catholic school and I knew about papal bulls.
Exactly.
So tell us more.
Okay. The doctrine of discovery is the term for papal bulls that were issued in the second half of the 15th century, that were in collaboration with the Portuguese and Spanish monarchs that authorized colonization and conquest and codified racism and slavery. So that was the origin of the transatlantic slave trade. And it really, codified that all people who were outside of Western Europe, i.e. black and brown people, were infidels and heathens and et cetera. And that it was that land and natural resources that did not belong to Christian European monarchs could be seized, could be taken, and that those profits, that land, would belong to the European monarchs, and those natural resources would be for the benefit and profit of the same monarchs.
And that leads us to the Pope. And the popes during that time that had enormous geopolitical power.
Enormous. I mean, they really were the, they established law. They were the lawmakers at that time. Absolutely. So those papal bulls were instantly international law. And other European countries adopted the doctrine. They said, great, now we can go and, seize these lands and natural resources, et cetera. So they jumped on that bandwagon. And so it really became, it is still international law. The doctrine of discovery is still embedded in international law, and was incorporated into U.S. law, hook, line, and sinker, in 1823 in a Supreme Court case. It was actually the very famous John Marshall who did that. And that case is the basis of all property law in the United States and is used as precedent by other countries, including Canada, Australia, New Zealand, etc.
And this film follows a number of young people, young Indigenous people from Minnesota, who go to the Vatican.
Yes, there was a group of Indigenous teenagers. They were all teenagers at the time in the Twin Cities, and it was a group that was formed by their mentor, who is also in the film, Mitch Walking Elk.
And what year was that?
When they went to the Vatican, it was 2018. So they heard about the doctrine. They learned about the doctrine, and they decided that they needed to get a meeting at the Vatican to explain to them why it was important for the, how the doctrine was impacting indigenous youth, climate, you know, people, indigenous people all over the world. And so they managed to get this meeting, and I traveled with them to Rome and filmed the meeting. But I think it's really, it makes the doctrine, you know, this story accessible to follow it and learn about the doctrine along with and through the eyes of these, you know, of these indigenous young people.
And was it Pope Francis?
It was Pope Francis at the time, although unfortunately he was not at the meeting, but a priest in his, who is Argentinian and his inner circle, was the one who hosted the meeting.
What was Pope Francis's response to this visit?
Well, I'm sure that he heard about it, but later on he came to Canada, to British Columbia, and people might recall that he issued immediately after that an apology for the residential schools that First Nations children were incarcerated in for a long time. So he did issue an apology. And then he later issued a statement of repudiation of the Doctrine of Discovery. But as is discussed in the film by people, it was sort of a shallow, it wasn't really a repudiation. You know, sorry this happened, but the countries did it, we didn't do it. So, and more recently, this Pope, Leo, apologized for the Vatican's role in the legitimization of slavery and referred to the Doctrine of Discovery. So the Doctrine of Discovery has played, which people don't, most people don't know about, has played a very significant role in you know, the history of the last 500 years, you know, up to today, continues to.
This is a film that all of us can learn from.
Exactly. This is something that impacts all of us. And I think, you know, one thing that people don't know is how it impacts us in terms of the climate crisis, because corporations and countries basically use the Doctrine of Discovery to take lands not only from indigenous peoples, but to, you know, take natural resources. You know, we're seeing it in this country. That is really goes back to the Doctrine of Discovery. So, of course, that issue affects all of us.
Will there be a Q&A?
Oh, definitely, which I'm really looking forward to doing. And by the way, I should mention that A couple of weeks ago, the film screened in Minneapolis to an audience of 700 people.
Well, congratulations.
And it was extremely well received. So before that, it was at Ganondagan, at the Seneca Arts and Culture Center. There's all these screenings. It was in New York City. It's basically going to be on tour for the next, I don't know, year or more.
Well, we're fortunate that you will be here with your film at the Calicoon Theater on July 8th. That's a Wednesday. And Gwendolyn, could you give us your website so folks can learn more about you and your work?
Oh, thank you so much for the reminder. The website is thedoctrinemovie.com. So that's thedoctrinemovie, all one word, .com.
And also, folks can go to the Calicoon Theater website for scheduling information. Thank you so much for taking the time to share this important issue with our listeners.
Valerie, thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you. And I really look forward to coming up to Calicoon.
Well, we look forward to seeing you here.
Thanks to cultural reporter Valerie Manzi. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. And as the nation is commemorating the 250th anniversary of America's founding, a presentation this weekend at the Time in the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville offers a closer look at what life was really like for the ordinary men who fought for independence. While history often focuses on famous battles and military leaders, the daily reality for Revolutionary War soldiers was filled with hardship, disease, grueling work, and moments of unexpected humor. Joining us now is historian and presenter Paul Misko, whose multimedia program, Life of a Revolutionary War Soldier, explores the experiences of those who served on the front lines of America's fight for independence. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, and as the U.S. is marking the 250th anniversary, your presentation, as I said, looks beyond these famous battles and generals to the everyday soldier. Why is it important to understand the war from their perspective?
Well, one of the main things is it's when people look back in time, they always are a lot of, it's very easy to say, oh, I would have been on the American side and not with the British, and I would have stuck it out the whole duration of the war, you know, because the Americans won. It's easy to look back and say, yes, that's the side I would have been on. But and when you look at the actual soldiers' life and the hardships they had to go through, the struggles to get equipment that they were promised, clothing, food, that Congress, you know, had promised the Continental soldiers, times of starvation, frostbite, you don't know what's going on with your family, lack of communication. I have to wonder myself if I would have stuck with it or I would have deserted and just gone back home. Not an easy thing to go through when you're not, you know, you're not aware exactly if you're going to win or what's going on.
Who were these soldiers that made up the Continental Army? What kinds of people answered the call to fight?
Well, there were various groups that went out. There was the militia. There was there were state levies that every state had to come up with so many soldiers, and they had to equip themselves. Whatever you can get for yourself to go out in the field, that's what you had. But the Continental Army, once you joined, they gave you a musket and a uniform and other equipment. You were supposed to get a constant new supply of clothing and socks and food, but that almost never happened. But these were people of actually all ages, but mostly the youth. No surprise, kids as young as 14 and 15 were eager to sign up because it was exciting. It was like a big, exciting camping trip. And as is common with youth, you don't think you're the one who's going to get shot, you know. So it's almost like don't let the war end before I get to get in it, you know.
Exciting, but dangerous and difficult as well. And most people probably imagine soldiers spending their days in battle, but that wasn't usually the case. What occupied most of their time?
Well, a lot of it was long moments of just surviving and even boredom, punctuated by moments of sheer terror during the battle. That's a common theme throughout wars, but especially the Revolutionary War, you had winter when most of the fighting ceased on both sides. You know, you have Valley Forge, Morristown, were just surviving the bitter cold in handmade shelters was a day-to-day agony. A little better for the British. They had more equipment and they would quarter in people's homes more often. So there's many accounts, mainly from Joseph Plum Martin, and we have other accounts of people who went through these battles, went through these times, and wrote in detail some of the feelings they had and the experiences that they had to go through.
There's also some unusual stories or some funny stories, the human side of the war. Without giving away all of your presentation, can you share an example?
There was in the free time, Joseph Martin and some of his friends, you know, he was 15 when he signed up. So
wow. 15.
You could imagine when there's free time, the trouble, the mischief they would get into. And they had this thing which actually we did when we were in Boy Scouts. It's called sapling bending, when you would climb up a thin young tree as high as you can go until it bent over and your feet touched the ground. Well, he was doing that and his friends were watching him, and the tree broke. He hit the ground, got knocked out, and of course, like all good friends, they disappeared. And he kind of came to and went back to camp. They found a huge wagon wheel and sent it running down a hill, but then it veered over to the barracks and they were terrified it was going to kill somebody. So just being human, when there were times of when they could relax, they would have fun stuff and they would often get into trouble too.
And was the Continental Army more diverse than many people realize?
Yeah, you had, in fact, Martin recounts that when he was from New England, when he went, he was down in the Pennsylvania area, some of the locals said, "You don't look any different than we do." And he's thinking, well, what did you expect? You know, the states were almost like little countries in themselves. And you always had stories and rumors going around like, oh, those New Englanders are so different and so odd. And they kind of stuck with their own people from their own background because it's just more comfortable. But there was in the end, they all had to join in, certainly during the battles, and other times units would, you know, come together because they lost so many men to join up. And so he recounts some of the things, you know, the differences and how people ended up saying, well, we're actually pretty much the same, no matter what state you're from.
During this time of remembering and celebrating America's 250th anniversary, what lessons do you think that modern audiences can take away from learning about the lives of these ordinary Revolutionary War soldiers?
Well, I think it's to understand. I mean, the first thing Joseph Martin did when he signed up was his group went down to Manhattan and they were parading down Broad Street to the applause of a crowd, a 15-year-old kid. That was wonderful. But we have to think about veterans of all times, American veterans of the hardships, the people that got lost, the family members lost. In these wars, there were true misery that is often forgotten about or covered over. It's a good reminder of the sacrifice part of the freedoms we have.
That's historian Paul Misko. His talk, Life of a Revolutionary War Soldier, is Sunday at 2 at the Time in the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville. There's more information at timeandthevalleysmuseum.org. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And before we go, a reminder, it's our summer fun drive, and we're asking for your support so we can continue to bring you this wide variety of local news and culture and information and community connections that we bring you, not only here on Radio Chatskill every day at 10, but throughout the day, throughout the weekend, throughout the evening. Local music, local news, local journalism, all supported by you. And your support sends a powerful message that trustworthy local news matters, that community connection matters, and that public media deserves a strong future. So donate right now, 845-482-4141. You can also donate online, wjffradio.org, or go and try out the new and improved mobile app available for iPhone and Android. You can donate directly from your phone in the palm of your hand. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening to Radio Chatskill. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hello, I'm Michelle Martin. How's the newspaper where you live? Thin? Getting thinner? Publishing a few days a week, if at all? You're not alone. Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats.
It will sell off more of its daily newspapers.
The largest news organization is shrinking. It's
laid off nearly a quarter of its newsroom.
And that makes it harder to keep up with our elected officials and what they're doing. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part by keeping NPR and the station strong with a donation today. And we thank you.
Your gift keeps local news, culture, and NPR funded and freely available to the entire community. Give what you can to keep it going. It's so important right now. Donate at wjffradio.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
On Point is coming up next. Today's weather, mostly sunny and warmer. The nicest day of the week, high of 83. Clearing early tonight, then increasing clouds overnight with a low of 63. Tomorrow it will be a little more humid, a stray thunderstorm possible, high 83. Summer Fun Drive continues. Your support is needed, and there's several ways you can do it. Online, call us, or use the mobile app.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.